I've had three key arguments over the past X number of years. I mean, I've made individual calls like we're going to have a Cold War or there'll be, an individual action here, there, or whatever. But three overarching ones. And the first one was that we were heading back towards the kind of protectionism slash mercantilism and geopolitical problems that I'm describing. And that's been a long run call. The second one, and I think actually one of your guests recently, Lynn Alden, was referring to it, is that developed markets now look more like emerging markets. But then the last point is what you just said, that if you understand the totality of this, which comes from classical economic thinking rather than contemporary neoclassical or more financially based thinking, it's the great granddaddy of the topic that we normally discuss day in, day out. It is going to get much more complicated. Much more complicated. In fact, it even becomes similar to the kind of logic of strategy that more military-minded thinkers like Edward Luckback, who's a great read, by the way, speaks about that if you do something as an investor, it could actually be the complete opposite of what you need to be doing. That you have to be thinking about what's the other side thinking while I'm doing this. And there's always a degree of that in markets. But it's going to become much, much more so, much, much more so as everything becomes geostrategic.
Welcome to Thoughtful Money. I'm its founder and your host, Adam Taggart. Since today's guest was last on this program in December, the world has continued to fracture geopolitically. Where's that trend taking us? And what will the impact be on global prosperity? The majority of folks who watch this Thoughtful Money channel are primarily from the US, Canada, Europe, and Australia. So to provide a perspective from a non-Western point of view, I'm pleased to welcome Michael Every back to the program. Michael's global strategist at Rabobank and joins us from Thailand. Michael, thanks so much for taking the time out of your busy morning to join us.
It's a great pleasure to be here. And can I say it's a great pleasure to talk to you after having finally met you in person, because everyone watching, if you think Adam is a great guy on screen, he's even better in real life.
You stole my material, my friend. I was literally gonna lead with that when you handed the baton back to me. But thank you. So yes, we got to spend time in person in Florida back in late January, I think it was ish around that time. And fortunately, we got the chance to hang out for the better part of a day. And of course, we had the event that night. But yes, it's always so fun, Michael, when I still consider myself to be just incredibly blessed with this job, because I kind of get to reach out and talk to my heroes. And whenever I get to meet one of them in person, it's always such a joy. And I will say, there is a lot of, I think, truth to the old expression, never meet your heroes, because people rarely live up to your highly romanticized notion of who they are. You're definitely one of those gentlemen who breaks that mold. You're even better spoken and even kinder in person. So anyways, it was wonderful.
Well, thank you. I'm blushing. I mean, I'm probably a lot shorter than people think. That's something I'll say.
Not in mental stature, my friend. You're a giant in that case.
Well, thank you.
All right. Well, look, got a bunch of questions here for you. I have had a lot of people over the past 2-3 months ping me directly in the comments of this YouTube saying, when are you going to have Michael Every on back? So folks, hopefully you're getting exactly what you wanted here. Like I said, I've got these prepared questions, but let's start with the general question I like to ask you at the beginning of these discussions. What's your current assessment of the global economy and financial markets?
Well, markets and the global economy are actually two completely different things. So
they are.
I have to give you two completely different answers. Markets are continuing to try and look for the upside in everything. And in many respects, I think a lot of markets are in la-la land. But the actual global economy itself is really at a crossroads in many, many respects. And I can't recall a time in the 25 years I've been doing this job where it's less certain what lies ahead of us, which direction we're going to take. And I think one of the important aspects of that, which we can unpack, I hope, is that the direction we're going to take may vary by geography. And that becomes a very complicated thing to forecast. It's not just, is it going to get better? Is it going to get worse, et cetera? It can do both at the same time.
Okay. All right. So I remember from our previous conversation that a number of your answers to the questions I asked then and likely to the questions I'm going to ask you now, your answers are sort of like, well, it's going to be kind of like a patchwork quilt, right? There's going to be, some parts that do better than other parts. There's going to be, balkanization of alliances, and some parts of the world will do one thing, some parts will do another. So let's dig into this. If I'm remembering correctly, generally you see the global economy kind of bifurcating into what I believe you've defined as the West and the global South. And correct me if I'm mislabeling those, where nations increasingly favor mercantilism with its protectionist agenda, versus the globalization trend that's been driving the global economy for, the past couple of decades. At a high level, did I capture that correctly?
You did. Let me just add a few little points. I think it's even easier if we just say the West and the rest
Okay,
rather than the
rest and the
global
rest.
South. It's
Easier
kind
to
of catchy.
say too.
Yeah, exactly. This is an argument I've been making for many years. It's not a recent one, but recent developments have accelerated it. I was making this argument 10 years ago, effectively, that this is where we would be stumbling towards. We have what you could call variable geometry or variable geography of who might sit where. But the overarching trend is, as you correctly say, towards more what we now call industrial policy, which is a term that's really coming back in a big way, protectionism and or mercantilism. And I do also think, without trying to, put questions in your mouth, it does probably justify just a very brief little discussion on what do we mean by protectionism and what do we mean by mercantilism, because actually they're different things, and that's part of the origin of the problem.
Great. So, my friend, expound away.
Okay, so protectionism is pretty clear in the name. You're trying to protect something that you've got. You've got an industry already. You want to keep hold of it because either it's important for national security, and that's very often the case, or all the good jobs and technology and spillovers are there. You want to retain that comparative advantage going forward. Now, of course, everybody wants the good job. In the comparative advantage theory, which we look at in a microeconomy of the boss and the secretary, and the boss can type faster than the secretary. But should the boss really be doing the secretary's work? No, the boss should be doing the boss's work and the secretary should be typing. I remember that one, when I was learning economics. That works within the microsphere, except for the fact that sometimes a secretary might think, I want to be the boss because they earn much more. They get to sit in the corner office. They get to, clock off at 3 and go and play golf. Why can't I be the boss? And you actually start getting into it, a rivalry, where you're going to night school and trying to get that corner office and maybe even undermine the boss by blackmailing them or, all kinds of surreptitious activities. This is real life. So that's protectionism. And you might be surprised to know that even Adam Smith, good old Adam Smith, who we all kind of refer to as the maybe, the first real economist in some respects, and also, the godfather of everything free market. He openly said, and I'll share the quote here if that's okay. He openly said that if a company or a firm in your country is doing something that's important for national security, and you can't rely on your neighbors to be doing that, maybe every other company should be taxed to help keep them in business. So Adam Smith completely advocated that in The Wealth of Nations, which we completely overlook today. So that's your protectionist argument, which is this is important for me. Let's look after it. I like the corner office. Then you have mercantilism. Now, Smith was completely opposed to mercantilism. Mercantilism is basically a mega version of protectionism. It's the difference between being a patriot and being an ultra nationalist, if you will. in terms of where the spectrum of ideas goes, which is I'm going to export as much as I can, and I want to import as little as I possibly can, and I want to just bank the cash or the gold in the old days, because if I control the money supply, I control everything. Now, do we have some mercantilist economies out there in the world today? And I would hope viewers are nodding their head and going, yep, we sure do. And you can't push back against a mercantilist with free trade. That's been one of my long-run theories I've been arguing for year after year after year. And therefore, I always said, even free traders of Red Smith are going to convert back towards protectionism to try and fight mercantilism. Now, they may not become mercantilists themselves. That's a whole nother step beyond, where you're trying to run as large a surplus and minimize imports. But at the very least, you're not going to give up certain industries. You're going to do everything you can to keep them. And I think that's both logical, necessary, and it's inevitable at this stage.
Okay, I may be oversimplifying things here, but is it maybe fair to think of protectionism as, hey, we want to take care of our interests, versus mercantilism is let's screw everybody else?
Yeah, that's a great way of looking at it.
Okay.
And obviously, one can teeter into the other. And if you're an exporter to a country that's got a good competitive sector, and suddenly you're shut out of that particular country or that sector because, the other country says, hey, this is important to us, well, it's going to feel like mercantilism to you. But the way you can judge if it is or it isn't at root is if you're exporting a whole lot more because you retain that sector, or you're not importing as much because you retain that sector, is your trade pretty balanced? Do you export pretty much as you import? If you're specializing in one sector, are you giving up another to
Right.
allow yourself to say, okay, so we need this. We don't need that. We're happy to buy that from you. That's how you get your comparative advantage. And let me just segue to one other little quote that I want to share here. This is another one that I've been arguing with my colleagues and with, interlocutors in the market for decades. If you read David Ricardo, who came up with comparative advantage theory, and I don't know an economist who isn't wedded to that idea. Ricardo, if you remember, back in the mist of time, Adam, he was looking at England making cloth and Portugal making wine, swapping each for each other. And he said, you should specialize just in one. And the math of that is compelling. Ricardo also said, and I'll share the quote. Ricardo also said, of course, England, the capitalists in England, would much rather produce the wine and the cloth in Portugal because it's cheaper. They would benefit from doing that. But they'll never do that. Because everybody knows no capitalist will ever let their money leave their hands and their country and go to a foreign country with dirty foreigners who you don't trust, because anything might happen to your money. So that will never happen. So, in other words, Ricardo himself builds in the case that if you have mobile global capital, and guess what we have? Mobile global capital, the free trade system breaks down because every capitalist will try and put all the production in just one country where it's cheapest. Everything will become destabilized, and you start tiptoeing towards either mercantilism or a backlash of protectionism in the other country. And last point here, and then I promise I'll shut up on this. Even Adam Smith, let's go back to Smith. You've heard of the invisible hand, right? I bet everyone listening has heard of the invisible hand, market forces. If you read Smith, he only uses that phrase three times in his whole body of works. Three times. The first time he's referring to the movement of the stars across the sky. Nothing to do with markets. The second time he says the rich can't help spending money on the poor because when they spend, it trickles down through society. Fair enough. There's your trickle-down theory, although he contradicts that in other places later. That might be close to how we interpret it. The third time he says no capitalist will ever invest their money abroad because an invisible hand will make sure they keep it close to home. So actually, Smith said the invisible hand said you should never invest in China if you're American, or in Russia if you're German, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Do you think we teach any of that in economics classes today? No. And then you
Well,
wonder
no.
why we stumble into protectionism and trade war and geopolitics.
So, do you sort of see then as the regression that we have right now, the unwinding of globalization, really as inevitable if one ascribes to the validity of the economic theories of Smith and Ricardo and others?
That's
Like,
been my
have we
fundamental.
basically been, so we've basically been deluding ourselves for the past couple of decades. That's been your fundamental argument?
Completely. I mean, look at long run history. Long run history is all about mercantilism and or protectionism and or geopolitics. So that's not changing. And that's not going to change going forward. We had a beautiful little window post World War II. And it took World War II to do it, where we had a US and Western centric system which worked well for the West. A third of the world was communist and not involved, and a third of the world was in the global South or the rest, pretty socialist, pretty closed, and selling the West cheap commodities most of the time, which fueled a lot of our boom.
Right.
And then after the Cold War finished, then we had a brief window where we thought, right, free trade. Let's edit out all the annoying ideological inconsistencies from our theory and our textbooks, which I've just pointed to. And maybe we bring everyone into this big tent. We'll never have any more war, any more conflict, any more arguments over who's running a trade surplus and who's running a trade deficit. No more mercantilism, no more protectionism. Manna from heaven, utopia. Well, it was nonsense. It was never going to last. And obviously, now all the fundamental imbalances that we've built up in multiple dimensions on multiple fronts, whether it's inequality, debt, trade surpluses, trade deficits, environmental problems, geopolitics, they're all conflating together.
Okay, I think I know your answer, but was the attempt to do that noble or naive in your
Naive.
mind? Yeah,
Completely
okay.
naive. I mean,
So,
it doesn't hurt that it made rich people richer. That's one of the reasons why we did it.
But so if you had been economic czar back at the time, you would have said, guys, yeah, sounds nice, but bad idea, going to come back to bite us. And we should focus more on what I think you think the more natural order of things is, which, I mean, you sort of said that free trade can't engage it can't push back on mercantilism. So to a certain extent, protectionist strategy and leaning on what you do best and largely making other trade-offs in your economy, that's the natural order. And it seems like you think that that's where the pendulum is going to be swinging back over the arc of at least the next decade plus, correct? Or maybe the rest of our lifetimes.
I think so. I mean, if you eliminate the possibility of everyone re-embracing free trade, and I think we can eliminate that, then all you're left with is the spectrum of how far down the road you go and whether you fight fire with full fire, like a real mercantilism, or whether you just stop at protectionism with industrial policy, which is linked to trade policy, that these sectors are ours. Those sectors are yours. And one of the clashes we see fundamentally now is the US attempting to say, hey, look, we're protectionist, which you clearly are now. You're clearly protectionist, and we want these sectors.
Well, I mean,
And
like
the
the
irony
CHIPS
being
Act's a great example of that, right?
completely, completely. And the irony being, on the other hand, the US is being fairly transparent about that. We're now protectionist. And you have mercantilists of two different forms. On one hand, you have China, obviously. And on the other, you have Germany, great sinners in this regard, too, as well. They always export, never import. And they're preaching to the US the joys of free trade and saying, no, Adam Smith, Adam Smith, Adam Smith. And China was just this week talking about David Ricardo and comparative advantage when they're doing everything they can with subsidies and industrial policy, and in Germany's case, repressing domestic demand to ensure that for every 100 goods they export, they only import 50. or 70, and in China's case, as low down the value chain as possible.
Okay, so what I don't hear you saying is you fear, you have a ton of fear, at least in the near term, that it's going to devolve into every country for themselves, and this just becomes a free for all. It seems like this is going to be more, you know, big trade alliances. I mean, basically the West and the rest to a certain extent. You know, it's not like you know, the US and Canada are going to start trying to, like, you know, squeeze the last nickel out of each other. They're gonna try to keep their allies as happy as they can while still playing to their protectionist priorities. And correct me if you disagree with what I'm saying.
No, I think that's the outcome. And it's the outcome for the simple reason that what you need to produce at the end of this, and I put emphasis on the word produce, is you need to have an economy that doesn't just reduce inequality, that doesn't just reduce the necessity for more and more and more debt, which is completely linked to this deterioration of the industrial backbone and you know, blue collar jobs. It's all linked together. What you need to do is have an economy which can produce stuff on a scale that can compete with others. So if you're talking about competing with China, which is just a phenomenal, phenomenal production machine, you need to have the US and Canada and Mexico, who, by the way, just this week suggested they're going to be raising tariffs on Chinese products coming into Mexico. So you can see that drawbridge is being raised as Mexico moves towards the US and Canada. And then the only real pivot point is who jumps in to that team. Now, Australia's in, Japan's in, South Korea's in, the Philippines is in, and that's all got a defense network umbrella to it. Pivot point is the UK, although they're in AUKUS, so they're kind of leaning in that direction. Although, as a Brit, let me tell you, we don't have any idea where we're going in the UK at the moment. We are just rudderless. And then Europe. And Europe is the big question. Is Europe going to join the West or the rest, or is it going to think it can do it by itself? That's really the big turning point.
Wow, really? I mean, the transatlantic partnership is probably the oldest standing, at least Western alliance around. I'm sort of I don't know the geopolitical landscape nearly as well as and geo economic landscape nearly as well as you do, Michael. But that kind of surprises me. And I guess I could see maybe they might think maybe we can be our own bloc, although I can't imagine they wouldn't want to partner with the US, but I'm a US guy, maybe I'm too biased. I'd be shocked if they thought they could join the rest. Is that really a credible option here?
Well, let me be very clear. Europe doesn't talk with one voice. It never has, it never will. And that's part of its problem, of course. And that's going to get worse going forward. Because on this critical point, three camps are really important within the European sphere. The first one is France. Now, even as an American, and I don't mean that in any pejorative sense, I'm sure you're aware that, you know, France has form in terms of being a global player. You know, they're still on the national the UN Security Council. They've got a trifecta of nuclear delivery systems. They're, you know, they're a big, powerful, important economy, and they think of themselves still in a Napoleonic sense. You know, in fact, I think back to one of the more ridiculous comments made by a past US president who criticized the French and said they don't even have a word for entrepreneur. And
Oh
if you
man.
Yeah, if you remember that, I remember it vividly.
How revealing of the American mindset, and lack of education.
indeed. So look, so France is important, and France likes to think Europe could become a big France. I think they're wrong, but they're pushing for that.
Okay. So
They're pushing for that hard.
France doesn't think they're part of Europe. They think Europe's part of France, is what you're saying.
Yeah, and if they could get all of Europe to be like France, with France leading it, possibly they could do something. So that's the first camp. The second camp is the newer members who joined 20 years ago in Eastern and Central Europe, and the guys who just joined NATO in Scandinavia. They're pro-US to their bone marrow because they live right next door to Russia. And they're well aware of the fact that the Western Europeans are very, very big on the European family of nations until it looks like Western Europeans might have to fight and die to protect Eastern Europeans, at which point there's a very awkward silence of, should we really have let them in the EU? Is there some kind of associate membership we can give them? Let me assure you, this is a thing. So the East and the North will lean towards the US. Poland, in particular, has already asked to station US nuclear missiles in Poland. That's how pro-US they are. That could be a whole Cuban Missile Crisis, by the way. Then you've got the third camp, Germany. Now, I want to be very careful in what I say because I can sometimes be a little bit too harsh. We're in public. I don't think the Germans have had decent geopolitical leadership with complete freedom of choice rather than being under a US umbrella where they, had a very narrow spectrum of what they could do since Bismarck.
Okay, that's a ways back.
Yeah. So we're talking the 19th century, not even the 20th. It's ridiculous how far back you have to go to find a Germany which was confident and fully independent and which didn't then make the most egregious of errors in terms of who it became friends with and or what it did. And if you listen to the conversations within national security circles and more, let's call them national conservative circles within Europe, people are pulling their hair out that Germany learned nothing in terms of how it dealt with Russia and was burned on that front, and is still hoping to reconcile with Russia at some point soon, secretly, and is meanwhile doubling down on China, despite the fact that everyone around it is trying to decouple or saying this isn't a very good strategy and it will come back to bite you. In a nutshell, German foreign policy is set by the largest German firms who see what's good for them, not what's good for Germany. And by the way, the same is true in America, you could argue, and the same is true in other countries which have large corporates which dominate. There's academic evidence to back this up as well as just anecdote.
Wow. Okay. So you're saying that I guess driven by its large corporate power players that see opportunity for them, that Germany, Europe's biggest economy, one of, if not the most critical player, is kind of leaning towards the rest, or is dreaming of leaning towards the rest.
They don't know what to do. I mean, they don't have a clear game plan. But if you said to them, look, you have to accept you're not going to be part of the rest, there's going to be a hard break, that would be a very, very hard sell to Germany. Very, very hard sell indeed. And so how is Europe collectively going to make that decision when the east of it would say, we're Atlanticists through and through? France would say, look, we're Gaullists and everyone follow me. And Germany says, we just want to sell cars, which, by the way, they're not doing a very good job of anymore. Even the German market is being flooded with Chinese vehicles. And you're actually starting to see German manufacturers say, well, maybe we should just, collaborate with China more, which in an industrial setting may make sense, but it speaks to the problem. Are they going to try and protect that sector? Let's go back to what I was talking about. And keep all those jobs in that industrial supply chain, or are they just going to end up basically being, cannibalized through M&A with Chinese companies? At which point, then can they sell to the US market, or is the US going to say you're now too Chinese, we don't buy from you anymore?
And that's where I'm going with this, which is, first off, if folks are watching from Europe, Germany, France, some of these other countries that we're talking about, love to hear your comments based upon this conversation. I'm very much without a map here, just because I don't know the on the ground details of Europe all that well. I just want to be super clear about that. Obviously, you being Brit and spending a lot of your time in a lot of those countries, I know, even Russia, you've got a much better sense for this than I. So where I'm going with this, the next question I want to ask is, so what trends should we expect heading into this more bifurcated and protectionist, and some protectionist, some mercantile future? So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. And you've already given us, some idea of reshoring, investing in domestic manufacturing, those types of things. But I would imagine that, like let's say Germany, let's say if America is really thinking that Germany is like questioning which team it's going to be on, I don't think it's beyond us to play hardball with those guys to get them back into the fold. So do you expect a lot of kind of, geopolitical chess and strategizing and strong arming, to kind of draw the hard lines between the West and the rest?
Enormously so, enormously so. And look, everything at this point is linked, because when you're playing this game, you're playing for very, very high stakes for the long term. And of course, it's going to affect markets. It's going to affect, sorry, affect investment decisions. But you have to be cognizant of the fact that the irony is you can get wiped out by following what you think is the right trend. So let's say, for example, you say, right, we're going to have reshoring, we're going to have onshoring, we're going to have industrial policy, which we are, absolutely. That's the case. What are the takeaways from that? Well, first of all, it's inflationary. So anyone trying to sell you that we're going to be back in a low inflation world, that's pretty unlikely, because that process of trying to drag production and supply chains back from where we've moved them for the past 40 years is inflationary. You're having to basically redo everything from scratch. It's going to invert a lot of things that we took for granted. Like, for example, how many kids, think I'm going to go and get a degree at a US Ivy League university in golf course studies or something. And then, there's a 6 or 7 digit salary waiting for me. Well, besides all the other tragic, hoo-ha, shall we say, that we've seen on college campuses in the past couple of weeks, and which I'm sure we're going to see more of going forward, there's not going to be any need for that within the kind of economy that you're talking about. Like, you need to be going back into engineering.
It'll be
You
much
need to
more
be going
trades
back.
driven, right?
Yeah, you need, this is completely trades different. So all the jobs that were being poo-pooed as the past are the ones where the real money is going to be going forward with a lag. And the wages there are already going to be going up. The ones where you thought all your dream white collar job where you got your sushi delivered at lunch for you, they're going to be the ones that, if anything, they can still be offshored because they can, that isn't national security. Or they're just not necessary. I'm a frivolous app designer. Wonderful. What does that do for national security? Not a lot. Bye bye. We don't need you. So that's an inversion. And then if you think, okay, as an investor, look, I can see this coming, so I'm just going to go for the sectors which are national security. Sometimes you'll be right. For example, within Europe, Rheinmetall, they're a big German defense firm. Their shares have gone through the roof. That was a no-brainer a few years ago. Okay. I'm not giving investment advice, but that kind of thing is a no-brainer. But equally, if you look at the benchmark from China, which we will have to copy to a certain extent, you don't want two big profits being made by these firms, because that profit isn't necessarily good for the company unless they're plowing it straight back into capital investment. So actually, you can have governments saying, yeah, we want much, much more activity here, but we don't want wild profits. We just want loads and loads and loads and loads of investment and a low and steady rate of return. Thank you very much. So it's not El Dorado. It's just very, very necessary. So that can
Okay.
be a completely counterintuitive argument that what is necessary doesn't give you a good return.
Okay. And I remember this from our previous conversations where you were saying, to date, at least in the West, during the past era that we all know, because we lived through it, the central planners, would stimulate or slow the economy generally as an all-in-one type of thing. Right, we're going to raise interest rates, or lower interest rates, and that's going to stimulate or slow everything together, right? And I believe you think the future is going to be much more targeted, much more surgical, which is we really want this industry to do well because we need it for our national interests. Let's stimulate that. We may have to starve these others to be able to do that. And to your point, they might even stimulate that sector. But they might have reasons to say, but we don't want that sector to get plump with profits. We want those spoils to be redistributed elsewhere. And so, I mean, that is a much more complicated world as an investor because you really have to not just think of specific companies and the global, the general macro situation, you've got to kind of think of all these other different layers. Like I said, it's almost sort of like 3D chess that you got to go to. So you're nodding as I'm saying this, but sounds like you're saying the era we're entering is going to be a much more intellectually challenging era for investors because you're going to have to factor in a lot more variables.
But you've just said it much better than I could. Yeah, thank you. I mean,
That's not true. I'm just trying to take good notes, buddy.
I've had three key arguments over the past X number of years. I mean, I've made individual calls like we're going to have a Cold War, or there'll be, an individual action here, there, or whatever. But three overarching ones. And the first one was that we were heading back towards the kind of protectionism slash mercantilism and geopolitical problems that I'm describing. And that's been a long run call. The second one, and I think actually one of your guests recently, Lynn Alden, was referring to it, is that developed markets now look more like emerging markets.
Yes.
I was trying to flog a t-shirt with a DM equals EM, but
I
no
remember
one
you
was.
saying that actually
Yeah,
earlier. You're right.
yeah, yeah. No one was a buyer, but maybe because I'm not producing them. There's the irony.
You're just too ahead of your
And the
time, my
last one
friend.
was. Which is no good in markets, as you know. But then the last point is what you just said, that if you understand the totality of this, which comes from classical economic thinking rather than contemporary neoclassical or more financially based thinking, it's the great granddaddy of the topic that we normally discuss day in, day out. It is going to get much more complicated. Much more complicated. In fact, it even becomes similar to the kind of logic of strategy that more military-minded thinkers like Edward Luckbach, who's a great read, by the way, speaks about, that if you do something as an investor, it could actually be the complete opposite of what you need to be doing. That you have to be thinking about what's the other side thinking while I'm doing this. And there's always a degree of that in markets, but it's going to become much, much more so, much, much more so as everything becomes geostrategic.
All right. Well, gosh, we're gonna have as I do every week, we're gonna have our endorsed financial advisors on after you here, Michael.
Oh, they're lovely. I can't imagine how much they'll be pulling their hair out trying to think about this.
For sure. You're making them think about what a challenging couple of decades they have against ahead of them. But one of the things that they do that I think you're kind of making a good case for is, not only is more of an active than a passive investing strategy going to be needed going forward, but you're really going to want to, like, risk management, hedging, those things are going to become very important because you just can't have great certainty in this world. And so you're going to want to make sure that you've got some insurance in case your main theses turn out not to unfold the way you thought.
Completely agree. I mean, I think that is one of the essential takeaways from this. You need to be hedged, and you need to be very thoughtful about everything you're doing, because the world is changing, and it's changing faster than many of us can keep up with.
Okay, so we got a little bit of time left, but not a lot. So I want to try to cram some very important questions in here. One of which is, I think you understand the American analogy. I don't know what the cricket, equivalent is, but where are we in the unfolding of this bifurcation that you see between the West and the rest, and the move to protectionism and more mercantilism? In other words, what inning would you put it in? And just to make sure, I think you know, but there are 9 innings in an American baseball game.
Oh, they're nine. Okay, right. So we're probably like in the second inning.
Okay. So we're
It's
pretty early on in this.
pretty early on, and you can tell. Because the debate that's currently happening very much in America, and it's happening on the Democrat side and the Republican side simultaneously, but in different ways, is what are we and what aren't we allowed to do? And it's starting to bleed across into all different areas. Like we've recently had that Wall Street Journal report that Trump, if he wins the election, he's thinking about, removing Fed independence. Well, that's part and parcel, purely hypothetically, by the way. Of strands of what you've heard me saying in past chats, that you would have to have a much more political central bank understanding, we help this sector, we don't help that sector. We want more of this, we want less of that. Swap lines for those guys because they're our friends. No swap lines for those guys because they're not. And that is overtly political, and it's naive to think it isn't. But
Yeah,
until
sorry
that's
to
fleshed
interrupt.
out.
Sorry to interrupt, but just so you can include in your answer, you know, one of the things that's been brought up a lot in as criticism to the U.S. is when Russia invaded Ukraine, we froze Russia's financial assets, right? And a lot of people saw that as a Rubicon, right? And a lot of people said, "Oh my gosh, it was a terrible mistake for the U.S. It's now sown doubt across the world, even amongst its allies." And there's this rush to de-dollarize and do trade in other currency. I mean, just all sorts of knock-on effects. I'm thinking you would say that was predictable. Like, this is a strategy you would expect to see in the type of world that you see unfolding here. Is that true?
Yes and no. I mean, I think as an end point, it was predictable. I'm not sure if it was the smartest strategy to do it now, because it does massively exacerbate our problems, and it does massively accelerate the dynamic we already have, which is of the other side saying, well, okay, what are we going to put our money into then? If we can't keep it in US dollar assets, let's put it in something else. And of course, they're going to put it A into hard assets, which is a whole different investment thesis. And I'm sure you're, completely, au fait with that already. But if we're not going to do that, let's put it into more physical production so that we can make more stuff, which, let's be frank, has military spillovers and very often is directly militarily targeted, so that without having to fire a bullet, we're in a position so that the other side understands if things ever get really bad, we win. And therefore, we can scare them away. So you massively accelerate the impulse to what needed to be done, but maybe could have been done more slowly. Now it's going to have to be done faster and in a more disruptive manner.
Okay, but it is, that is a tactic of the world we're heading into. You think we just played that card too early in the game?
Well, it's a tactic. It didn't have to go this way. I mean, if you look back to the way the world used to run, there are really disgraceful anecdotes the other way. Like, for example, after Nazi Germany, invaded Czechoslovakia, the Czechs had some of their gold reserves back in the days when we still had gold being kept with the Bank for International Settlements. And the Nazis requested it, and the BIS just handed it over and said, yeah, it's yours now. I mean, that was a kind of a completely, hands off, gold is gold, no one touches anything. Was that a better world? I'm not 100% sure, but I don't know if going to the other extreme of politicizing everything is necessarily much better.
I'm sorry, I might have interrupted a point you were going to make. If I did, please make it. But let me just ask this question and pull whatever you want into the answer, which is, we've got the West, we've got the rest. Does one side have an advantage, a greater advantage here? Yeah, I know we've talked a little bit in the past about some of the people who are in the rest. You sometimes think we maybe ascribe a little bit too much competency to them, because I know you've spent time in some of these countries and you've obviously spent a lot of time researching them for Rabobank. But I don't know. I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Well, both teams or sides have enormous potential strengths and huge potential weaknesses. And right now, through pretty poor management for generations, the West is not doing very well. In previous conversations, I've said that we had the strongest hand in history, the strongest card hand in history, and we just keep throwing away aces, just like, oh, who needs an ace? Oh, another one, I'm bored with these, or maybe ace is low, right? Is ace high or low? I think it's low. I'll get rid of it. So
Actually,
we're making.
can be either, but let's call it the highest. Yeah.
So let's say in the game it's high, but we're not sure, so we're throwing it away. But yeah, we're making tremendous mistakes. And the academic record of looking at this from the past really raises some warning flags, because the other side has also enormous demographic weakness, enormous problems with debt, enormous problems of trust. Enormous problems left, right, and center. But what they do have is an enormous stock of commodities to hand right now, which are only going to grow in importance going forward.
Yeah, they've got a lot of
And
real stuff.
they own real stuff, and they can produce much more than we can right now. Now, their problem, besides the internal weaknesses which they have, is if they're really going to cross their Rubicon and say, well, all this stuff is for basically, let me be blunt, blowing up you rather than anything else. We're not going to be buying from them anymore. So once you do that, you've got a lot of excess stuff. And what are you going to do with it? I mean, even you've got a lot of excess unemployment if you don't do anything with it. So it's not as if there's a smooth, easy path out of this for either side, because if there were, we'd be doing it already. I'm not trying to underplay how bad the situation is in the West. It's bad, really bad. But one thing is also true, that if you are the net importer in this scenario who isn't producing anything, let's go full circle. You've been predated on by a mercantilist, which we have. If you're going to shift back to protectionism, if you do it right, if you do that right, it's a world of hurt for the mercantilist, not for the protectionist who's catching up. But you've got to do it right.
Okay, interesting. So, you and I, when we were in Florida, we spent time with Brent Johnson, and you were actually on his side of the panel that I moderated. And I think Brent has a similar view, which is, yeah, look, you can criticize the U.S. all you want. We've certainly made lots of blunders, whatever. But at the end of the day, we have these amazingly powerful assets, including the US dollar on a relative basis to the other world fiat currencies. He's basically just says, to the critics, he's like, look, on whatever issue you want to come after me at, like, do you not think that if we finally got our act together and just decided that this was a priority, that we couldn't just crush everybody on key dimension X? I'll take a pause and let you react to that if you feel differently. But one of the things that I hear you saying is you got to do it right. It's a lot easier to change policy than it is things like geography or demographics, right? You can't suddenly make your country have different, national borders, or you can't invent resources it doesn't have, right? Or you can't magically print up a doubling of your working age population, right? So it's a lot easier to change bad policy into good policy. I've got optimism that any country that wants to, including my own, can do that. The problem is knowing how things are done. It's probably going to be done like almost as a last resort. Like, it's probably going to take a lot of pain before we finally say, okay, let's do it the right way.
Well, I'm sure that's true, because that's true everywhere. But I think we are moving closer to that point of praxis where it starts to happen. And I mean, if we're looking ahead to the US election later this year, that itself could be a point of praxis, because let's say we get Biden coming back in again. Well, we know what we're going to get. We're going to get an amplification and an acceleration of what we're seeing now, the kind of policies which are already moving in that direction. He can't back off of that. You have to do more. It snowballs. That's just logical. And at the same time, if you say, okay, so it's Trump, not Biden, he's even more radical. If you
I
listen
was
to
going
the
to say
guys
Trump
around
would
Trump,
totally accelerate that, right?
oh, on steroids, on stilts. I mean, it's extremely difficult to be bearish the dollar from an investment perspective when you either have creeping protectionism, which is dollar positive, or what could be all-out mercantilism. Because that's Brent's argument too. If you're going to go to mercantilism, how do you earn the dollars to pay back your offshore dollar debt? Where do they come from? That offshore dollar debt is enormous, and it sits there. Unless you're going to blow that entire pool of assets up, like boom, everyone defaults. Well, good luck to the entire global financial system and trading system. I hope you've got something in your back pocket ready to move goods from A to B, because everything just blew up. If it's not going to blow up, how do you service it? So that's why narrowing the US trade deficit strengthens the US. It doesn't just bring industry back. It doesn't just narrow inequality, which it does. It doesn't just help deal with debt problems, because the bigger the deficit, the bigger the debt. No, it also helps strengthen your geopolitical arm, which is why you will get a queue of economists coming out to say it's the wrong thing to do.
Okay. All right. Well, look at it. So I think I know what your answers would be, but let me ask this anyways. So, Michael, we make you the economic czar for, I'm going to pick a team, Team West, but if you want to do it for the rest, go for it. But we make you the economic czar for Team West. What would your strategy be? Would it be do protectionism right?
Yeah, I mean, look, logically, this doesn't come from a normative stance of what I want to do, but if you address all the problems and say, what won't work? That's my methodology. What will not work demonstrably and logically? Whatever's left, no matter how much you don't like it, that's what you have to do. And it is what you were, summarizing my view on earlier, which is do protectionism right, not mercantilism. Do protectionism right and do that with whatever policy levers you have to use. For example, if you have to say, right, zero interest rate loans for this particular sector, but everyone else has 5.5%, you do that. If you have to have more of the bureaucrats who are currently going around measuring carbon footprints and whether the supplier to your supplier uses styrofoam or ceramic mugs in their canteen and the carbon footprint that went into those mugs, if you have them actually also measuring a map of who's producing what at what value-added point right the way across the economy, so you have a map of supply, so you can help with computers to actually target what needs to go where. Even if it sounds like, my goodness me, that's a planned economy. Yeah, if you have to do that, you do that, because the alternative is worse. The alternative is basically a continual deindustrialization, growing inequality, growing polarization, growing destabilization, growing radicalization. And the signs are evident, the flashing red indicators, and a whole broad range of disciplines and areas, that it ends in a very, very bad place,
Okay,
if
and
not just
I
geopolitically.
assume war, both international and civil.
Yeah, it's a head to head, and I've thought that for a long time. Which one comes first? I mean, hopefully we can stick to just movies like the recent one, Civil War in America, and it never gets any worse than that. And I'm sure that will be the case, but something radical needs to be done. And even in Europe, just as a parallel, we've now had the former president of the ECB, the European Central Bank, Mario Draghi, former technocratic prime minister of Italy. None more, let's use the pejorative word, globalist, none more, elite, none more insider than him, come out and say, you know what Europe needs to do? Hybrid policy, protectionism, industrial policy, strategy, along those lines. And the implication being, yeah, and higher interest rate for some and lower interest rate for others. And even the president of the ECB now, Lagarde, a year ago, she alluded to the same thing. Government and central banks holding hands to try and achieve a geopolitical goal. And that's the only way, she said, you'll get low inflation. That's how they're justifying it. But there are other ways to justify it.
All right, so there's a whole other conversation that we don't have time to have here. One about the wealth inequality, and I know that this is something that you've written about a lot, and you and I think have even talked about it in our personal conversations. But also, like for protectionism to work well, yes, it's going to be more kind of command and control, but you need to kind of have the populace bought in to the national good, right? Like, okay, we're going to be in this era where we're kind of being told we have to make sacrifices over here to help things over here. And it's going to become a little bit less about how do I get as much as I can get and live a Kardashian lifestyle. And it's more like I'm an American or I'm a German or I'm a whatever. And we're all working towards some greater national good here. Is that true?
I think that's inevitable. And again, a broad range of commentators from a broad spectrum of disciplines are underlining the fact that if you don't do it fairly soon, it's not only going to be just elite kids at universities waving flags shouting, I am Hamas, or we are Hamas. Everyone needs to be saying, no, we're American. And America can mean many different things to many different people, as can being German, being British, whatever. But if we can't rally together, those sacrifices and trade-offs are going to be harder to make. And they are going to be hard to make. And obviously, the people who are going to hate it the most are going to be the ones who do best out of the current system. They'll be the ones kicking and screaming and saying, no, nothing should change. And they're pretty powerful. They have a lot of influential and intellectual voices, but they're wrong. And I do think they will lose over time. But if they don't, it will just make things far worse before we get there.
Okay. All right. The closing questions here, and I've been working up to this one, which I'm sorry it took so long to get to, but is given your view of the world here, and we're talking about things that are going to be playing out over the next couple of decades, but I'm just curious, you work for Rabobank, you know, you guys are trying to help your clients make better investments. The folks that watch this video are just regular investors trying to see where the puck is headed. Are there certain types of assets or certain types of investing strategies that you think better suit the future that you see us walking into than others?
Okay, first of all, you're aware I don't give investment advice,
None
so
of this is
obviously
personal
that.
investment advice. Yes, you're totally absolved from that.
Okay. And to be even blunter, I mean, day in, day out, most of your other guests either manage money or have had kind of advisory roles or official roles within the markets. I don't do that. My job is global strategist to literally do the kind of thinking that I've shared with you and with everyone today. And then to sit down alongside the markets guys and say, so, you know, collectively, what do we think then? You tell me if I say that to you, where do you want to be? But there are clear implications, which is that making that sectoral choice within equities is going to be harder and harder to do, even if you understand the thematic envelope of reshoring, onshoring, reindustrialization, et cetera, et cetera. Then, you know, there will be clearly areas where you can make good money from that, and there'll be others where you shouldn't expect to make too much good money because that's just not going to be allowed. But from an overarching perspective, it is going to be inflationary. We haven't, you know, we haven't really spoken about the Fed other than, you know, what Trump is threatening to do. But it does not argue for an environment in which inflation just effortlessly drifts back to 2% again, and the Fed funds rate can come down, and we go back to the golden path that many would like us to be on. I don't see that as being the most likely scenario at all. The question is how far we veer away from that, either because everything goes badly wrong and rates have to come down a very long way, which some people think, or that they have to stay relatively far higher for far longer than many have been trying to sell us on for
Well,
a long time.
in an era of secularly higher inflation, you would think, one would think we would have to have secularly higher interest rates, one because interest rates were so incredibly low, you know, in the past decade plus, but also just because bond investors are just going to demand higher rates because of the higher inflation or
Indeed,
higher
and look,
yield, sorry.
absolutely, and I remember, I think the first time we spoke a few years ago, I was saying tips might be a place to consider, and you know, hypothetically, I still think tips have some appeal because they at least hedge you, but I
Commodities too,
think
I assume, in a broad brush, commodities in this world.
absolutely. I mean, commodities you have to be careful of because you get two different effects happening. On one level, they can be squeezed and or demanded, and that obviously pushes them higher. But you have to be prepared for the fact that every now and then the government will step in and say, right, we're going to crush that price because geopolitically we need that price to come down. And that can be from an opposing side saying, I'm going to bankrupt you, so therefore I'm going to try and push the price of that commodity down. Or, as we've seen happen recently this year in some metals, the key producers of that metal notice the likes of Europe saying, oh, we'd actually like to try and get our foot in the door in that industry, you know, to develop a bit of strategic autonomy. And they say, right, let's just flood the market. I'll take a loss for 6 months or a year just to push everyone else out of business, just to show them they can't compete economically. Then I'll jack the price up again in 2025. So you've got to be able to ride out those waves. And again, that comes back to a geopolitical mindset of understanding who's trying to dominate what and what tricks they'll use to do it. And it's not always a high price, sometimes it's a low one.
All right. Fascinating. All right. Well, Michael, look, very much look forward to having you back on the program. I feel like we are just in the second inning of this discussion. Thank you for giving so much of your time and so much of your highly informed and academic and really just fascinating view of where things are headed. I know I'm going to get a lot of hate in the comments that we couldn't let this run longer, but we're just going to have you back on the program again, my friend. Two last questions for you. One is, where can people follow you and your work?
Okay, that's easy. Obviously, at Rabobank, you can go to Rabobank and have a look at the research page there. I also have a LinkedIn page, and a lot of what I write is available there. And I'm also on X, or Twitter, at the Michael Every. So at the Michael Every.
Great. And Michael, when I edit this, I'll put up the link to Rabobank and to your X handle there. Folks will also put the links in the description below the video too, so you can get there with one click. All right, Michael, last question. Clearly you've amassed a ton of wisdom and you know just a great amount of knowledge in your career. You've had a very successful career. You have a great command of the scope of how the world works. What's a big lesson that you've learned along your journey that you think is worth sharing with the audience here? It can be a career lesson, it can be a life lesson, maybe one a mentor imparted to you, or maybe one the school of hard knocks has just beaten into you over the years. Do you have a choice bit of advice for folks?
Can I give two, one very short and one slightly longer?
Absolutely. Sure.
Okay, the short one actually is the only piece of really good advice that I was given by my first boss in financial markets 25 years ago when I first got the job. And I said, how do I start investing? With the $5 I had in my pocket. And he said, pay off your mortgage. Pay off your mortgage early. He said, when you look at the after-tax income, there's nothing else you'll be able to do that will beat that. Now, that may have changed depending on how you invest, but it stood me in good stead anyway. So that was a short one. The longer one, and speaking to the fact that when I got that job, I had like $5 in my pocket, is that for all the academic reach that I try and bring to this, I'm from a upper working class, lower middle class background in a rough town in the UK. And I'm not a rough individual myself, but I've certainly seen a lot of roughness around me. And I can assure you that if you only come from an academic background and you dwell purely in this realm of ideas, you're going to come across as the kind of model UN, knows everything but knows nothing individual who gets their pants pulled down regularly in the kind of world that I'm describing. And if there's any comparative advantage that I've managed to bring to my career, more and more in the recent couple of years when things have got nasty, is it's pretty easy for me to put on a kind of imaginary baseball cap and think, right, I'm a really mean individual. How am I going to screw with everyone here? And it comes pretty, I don't do this personally, but it comes pretty easily to me. And I find that the really academic people who come from nice, comfortable backgrounds, who have never had to worry about only having $5 in their pocket, are absolutely incapable of doing that. They have no idea how to think along the lines of how do I get home tonight, without getting punched in the face, because it's never happened to them.
So, sort of blend your passion and your pursuit of knowledge and intellectual wisdom with a scrappy street smarts, practical understanding of how the world actually works.
Again, nicely put, or go and live in a rough area for a few years if you want to try and experience it yourself. But yeah, the point being, you need some realpolitik, some realism in your own life. And the younger you are getting that, into your system, the better, because it sticks.
Got it. Got it. I think it's great advice, which is if you don't have it, seek it so that you can really understand that other side of life. And, hopefully it'll make you a better, more well-rounded person and thinker. Michael, it's always such a joy. Thank you so much, buddy. I really appreciate you scrambling in your morning to do this for us. I look forward to doing this again as soon as your schedule allows. And folks, let us know in the comments section when Michael comes back which topics you'd most like for us to dive into. But Michael, look forward to having you back in the program as soon as you can return.
Thank you very much.
All right. Well, now's the time of the program where we bring in the lead partners from New Harbor Financial, one of the endorsed financial advisory firms by Thoughtful Money. Normally, to react to what our guest has said, because of scheduling differences, I'm actually had to stay up late tonight to interview Michael because he's in Asia and that's middle of the night for the New Harbor guys here. So we're actually interviewing the New Harbor guys first, even though it's coming on after the segment here with Michael. So they haven't seen it yet. So guys, we'll have to get your commentary on Michael's, what I'm sure was scintillating insights next week. But there's a lot for us to talk about this week. So if we can, we don't have a ton of time. I just want to bang through as much material as we can here. Folks, as usual, I'm joined by lead partners, John Lodra and Mike Preston. Guys, good to see you. John, let's start with you. So we had Fed policy guidance update yesterday. In many ways, they didn't really release anything super new, I guess maybe with QT. But basically, they kept the policy rate unchanged, which is what was expected. Powell was really pressed hard during the Q&A as to whether he was going to raise rates or lower rates. He basically said, "Look, I'm not giving any timing guidance on either way. I'm just going to look at the data." Though he did say, one, it was the Fed has been surprised by how sticky inflation's been to get down below three. And he said it's going to take longer than we expected. So I think higher for longer has turned into high for even longer at this point. When pressed about rate hikes and what it would take for the Fed to do a rate hike, Powell said, "Look, I think hikes are unlikely." And the market has generally seemed to have liked that admission that the Fed's not planning on hiking even more. Of course, he said if something terrible happened, anything could be possible. But he really sort of told the market, don't worry so much about rate hikes. Now, I guess the news was on the quantitative tightening side of things. They are reducing the size of quantitative tightening going forward starting in June. They were doing $60 billion a month of U.S. Treasury roll-offs. That's going to be decreased down to $25 billion a month, so cut a little bit more in half. Then I think they're keeping the current cap they have right now and the roll-off of agency debt and mortgage-backed securities. I think that's at $35 billion per month, if I'm not mistaken. So still doing quantitative tightening, just not at the same pace. And Powell basically said, we plan to get to the same destination in terms of the ultimate low point of the balance of the Fed's balance sheet. But he just said it's just going to take longer. So anyways, those were the facts of the discussion. John, what else do you take away from it?
Yeah, so I was actually preoccupied for the actual announcement, but I did catch up after the fact. I was attending the National Association of Active Investment Managers conference in Orlando last few days. It was a great exchange of ideas and learning about markets among active managers like ourselves. But I did get a download and caught up on the reading. It's interesting because so much of the world, the markets hang on every word the Fed says, and it's been like that way for more than a decade now. And funny, some of the interesting commentaries I came across were the observations of not only just what was said or wasn't said, but how it was said. People honing in on awkward long pauses by Jay Powell, people commenting on how often he cleared his throat. Maybe he's sick, but a lot of people were saying he looked like he was scared and really trying to kind of not say the wrong thing. So I didn't see it live, but those are some of the textual or tonal kind of things that I saw people kind of teasing out of the statement, which I think is kind of ridiculous, but it is what it is. Adam, you
Well,
look.
it's sorry to interrupt, but right before it went on, I was watching it on the YouTube, but it was Bloomberg's channel, and the anchors right before Powell came on, they were like, "Look, Powell just needs to like not say anything, right? Just like he can basically only lose by opening his mouth here."
Well,
So at least
exactly.
the media's perspective, and maybe that's why he was sweating. Like, how do I say something that's not going to get, me in trouble one way or the other?
So I think the context for this most recent meeting is properly set by going back to late last year when Powell and the Fed started to quote unquote pivot. In hindsight, it was probably the very wrong thing for them to do. There was no reason they had to kind of get ahead of the data and start to telegraph that, hey, we think we're going to be able to cut rates three times in 2024. And of course, the market ran with that and went crazy with it. At one point, it was pricing in seven, eight cuts. And of course, since that time, inflation numbers have come in hot and that kind of thing. And I think much of the criticism, I think rightful criticism, is even some of the things he said yesterday. There was no need to say, for example, I'll just highlight a couple. So he talked about the mechanics of slowing down QT, how impactful that is, who knows? That to me tells me that the Fed is actually kind of scared about bond market liquidity, especially in the context of the deficit funding and the QRA quarterly funding announcements. I think they're worried about a spike higher in longer term rates that they
right. Well, especially too, as the reverse repo program maybe gets emptied, right? Yeah. And then it's no longer a cushion against QT.
Exactly. But you know, one of the things that he said is we feel, I'll paraphrase, but we feel less confident than we did last time about the pace at which we'll reach the 2%, the magic 2% inflation target. So that's kind of like saying, hey, you know, we kind of blew it. You know, it's a very soft way of admitting that we never should have communicated rate cuts last year. And he also, again, when pressed, said, I think the next move is unlikely to be a rate hike. There's no reason for him to say that. And so a lot of the criticism I've seen is like, look, they already kind of blundered by trying to telegraph too much. Just shut up and let the data and you know, policy and guidelines run their course, not your opinions or your prognostications about, you know, what you're going to do.
So John, just one point on that. So folks, if you haven't watched it, I did as I've now been doing the past, since we founded Thoughtful Money, is on the days that the Fed comes out and gives its policy update, and then Jerome Powell does his press conference. Right after that, I then have Axel Merck come on the program, and we do a live reaction video to that. So while the news is still really fresh, Axel is a career Fed watcher, and so he helps us sort of decode everything that the Fed said in real time. And then the audience, which the folks can watch live, are my premium Substack subscribers. They can ask any questions that they want. But the replay is available on this channel if you want to go watch it.
But let me share up a chart here just to kind of puts into context the last several months of interest rate expectations. This is basically the market's pricing of Fed cuts in 2024. So back late last year when the Fed was telegraphing, hey, we're going to be able to start cutting. You know, again, they telegraphed maybe 75 basis points, 0.75%. Of course, the market took that bit and went and ran with it. And at one point was pricing in, approaching 1.8% in cuts. But since that time, the market perceived level of cuts has dramatically declined. You know, this line rising means the depth of the cuts has gotten shallower and shallower. Yesterday, this chart was prepared yesterday, so maybe it's a little stale already, but there was a slight blip in the favor of somewhat more. I think it actually says right here, went from 27 basis points of cuts in 2024 to 32, a non-event pretty much, but this is the real event, the complete repricing. And you might even say the market maybe has gone too far in the other direction, that they now have taken off the table maybe too much the idea of cuts, because there's still, we'll get to it in a bit, there is some storm clouds and some breakage starting to happen in the economy, the kinds of things that the Fed looks at. We'll cover those later, I'm sure. But this has been a dramatic market reassessment of rate cuts for 2024.
Yeah, and maybe that's why stocks sort of started selling off in March, although of course the majority of that move was done before March, the walking back of the crazy expectations there at the beginning of the year. But one other thing on that too is it should matter to markets, right? I mean, just mathematically it should, but 2023, the whole year, the market kept expecting Powell to pivot, and he didn't. He kept, every time, he kept saying, nope, higher for longer, higher for longer. And of course, stocks just kept marching higher all year. So I'm a little skeptical of how direct the relationship might be between those expectations and market prices. But just to finish Axel's point, he basically said, look, I don't think we get anything from these Fed press conferences. I think they just stir up, they get everybody spun up, and they create unnecessary volatility, especially because the Fed doesn't really know what it's going to do in the future. And it has a miserable track record of forecasting. And so he said, back kind of before the global financial crisis, where it was thought they needed to communicate more directly just to give transparency to the markets and calm the markets that way. He said previous Fed eras, like, they didn't do these press conferences. And, we had an interesting discussion about, well, geez, maybe we should go back to that era. And he basically said they didn't even sometimes, there were periods where they didn't announce changes in the policy rate. they would just change it. And then they let the market figure it out in arrears, which is so opposite with what we have right now. But it does raise the question that maybe the Fed is over communicating in an unhelpful way these days.
Yep, totally agree with that. You know, they've been too much in the spotlight, and it seems like anything they can say now is more damage or more confusion than good.
All right. Well, I want to move on to what the market's telling us, and then some of those signs of potential weakness that you guys saw. So, Mike, I'm coming to you. So we're now most of the way through Q1 earnings season. What have we learned so far, and what are they making us think about the future?
Well, Adam, earnings have been mixed to negative, I'd say. There's been a lot of negative reactions to earnings reports, and so this is in stark contrast to what we've saw maybe even a quarter or two ago, where almost every earnings report was, there was just a really positive reaction on almost everything. So just a small sampling of some that I've noticed over the last week or two, all negative. Intel, AMD, Supermicrocomputer, Netflix, Microsoft, and there's a whole bunch more. These are all large negative moves after earnings. It's been a couple bright spots. There was Google last night, and then tonight there's Apple. By the time viewers take a look at this video, the Apple results will already be out. Apple, you know, being a over $3 trillion company, or close to a $3 trillion. I don't even know what the latest number is. It's roughly that. It's a huge market mover, potential event. Apple's been in a downtrend for quite a while. It's not the leader that it once was. And so that might transmit, you know, that may be signaling a negative move. But the way this market has been, it's more like the opposite. You really can't. There doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason or any follow through. So I wouldn't be surprised to see a positive result or a positive move in Apple. But overall, it's been a relatively mixed and negative situation. And this is while the market has pulled back. The S&P was down around 5% or so. We bounced back 2%, a little more. Then, of course, we had a big swing yesterday after the Fed decision. We were up as much as 50 S&P points at around 3 o'clock Eastern. And the last hour we swung negative, I think around 15 points. So that was around a 65 point move in just an hour. And we've taken aback about half of that move now as we speak. We're up around 30 S&P points. So it's really a mixed bag. The S&P's under the 50 day moving average, although it wouldn't take much to get it back over that. And so it's, the market could break down here, or it could break higher and cause shorts to cover with one bit of positive news. That bit of positive news could have been something out of Jay Powell yesterday, which we didn't get. It could be a positive result or a positive surprise from Apple, because the market's not expecting a lot from Apple right now. We'll see. Like John and I were talking earlier, we're seeing a lot of negative breadth deterioration across sectors and some sector rotation. For instance, we reduced positions recently in Brazil and uranium. They were going sideways to down. We still have those positions, but they've been reduced a little bit. But then we see positive breakouts in chart setups, like in utilities. So we just added a position in utilities. That's about 5% in our portfolio. So we're seeing a lot of movements, but nothing definitive. And so it's kind of like no man's land. We'll see. We have to get back above the 50-day moving average on the S&P, which is right around 5080, about 40 points above where we are right here. Or if we take out the recent low of a week or two ago, we could accelerate down. So we're going to have to wait and see, but we're going to see a catalyst, I think, pretty soon. It could be Apple. It could be something else.
Okay. So this is what technical analyst Sven Henrik often calls a battle zone for control, right? So I'm just curious, Mike. So let's look at two scenarios. One is next week, the S&P definitively punches above the 50-day moving average. And I know technically you like to see it fall back and then bounce off of that. So now resistance has become support. If that were to happen, do you guys plan to add to your positions?
Let me pull up. We probably would. If we get further follow through and strength, I think it would be the signal that we're probably going to have a run for the high and probably a further blow off top. We have to offer one caveat, though. We are in hyper overvalued situations. This isn't a quote-unquote real market. You know, the fact that we're all waiting with bated breath for every word the Fed says is an indication that this is all about the Fed and what the Fed's going to do. The market still anticipates Fed cuts. As John talked about a minute ago, the market is now saying it's probably not going to happen this year, but the market knows the Fed's going to cut as soon as we have a market event. And so it's a game of chicken. Our best guess is we probably do get a move higher, but we're not willing to bet on it, and we're not willing to bet on it unhedged. Here's a daily chart of the S&P 500. Here's the recent high, 5,264, a few weeks ago, about a 5% pullback, almost a 50% retracement of that. And then the last couple of days, here we are again, right back up below the 50-day moving average, which is this red line. This is the 50-day exponential moving average. The other two are shorter term, 10-day, 21-day. And then this thick green line down here is more of a line in the sand, a 200-day moving average, a much slower one. But a lot of traders are watching this 50-day moving average. And so a positive result from Apple, per se, could bring this on one big market update. We can take out that swing high here, close above the 50-day moving average, and make a run for the high. If that were to happen, we would consider adding very judiciously and lightly in strong sectors. We go through sector charts all the time looking for strong technical relative strength. And as I said, some of them started to break down, but others, like utilities, have started to break up. But look how easily it would this market could have a down day and break this recent low. And then all of a sudden, we would be worried about a run to this 200-day moving average. And that's a long ways down here. And we're not willing to make a bet ahead of time. And we're not willing to run our portfolio unhedged. We have roughly 50% overall exposure, 40% exposure to equities. Yet we have built-in hedges in place. This line down here at 4,900, we have a 15% notional exposure S&P 500 put. So if we had a big down move or crash, we would go through that floor. And that would immediately take off 15%, would bring us from 40% down to, you know, down to 25. We also have an in-the-money call option on the equal weight S&P, which is slightly out of the money. So that, in effect, has reduced our exposure, you know, probably a little bit below 40% that I just mentioned. It might mathematically be more like in the high 30s. But here, it's a mixed bag, and it's a little scary because we've had a lot of negative reactions to earnings reports. And so one big day either way is going to tell us what to do. Big day up, we'll be looking for charts to potentially add. A big day down will automatically take us into a lighter equity position.
Okay. All right. Well, I guess time will tell. These zones for control tend to not last terribly long, but who knows? John, I want to punt it back to you real quickly because we are now in May. And we talked a little bit about this last week, but I think you guys just published a video on your channel recently about the same topic, which is the old sell in May and go away adage. What's your current thinking on that right now, given the type of market environment we have?
Yeah, so first I want to be very, very upfront. These kind of slogan type investment strategies, we think are pretty much jokes. They're very lazy kinds of analysis, right? Because they basically are analyses that are based on averages. And there's a saying that we like to repeat, an analysis based on averages is an average analysis. There's so much underneath the surface that when you average over many different years or seasons, you miss the context. So let's use a hypothetical case. Like, I don't know what the rule is, but you know, there's oftentimes a often repeated truism that, hey, as goes January, so goes the year, right? And let's just make up a number. Let's say if January is up 95% of the time, the year's up. I'm just picking that number hypothetically. And to the layperson that says, well, geez, that's pretty darn good odds. You know, I got a 95% win rate. Why would I be fully invested for the year? The problem with that is this notion of what's called conditional probability. That 5% chance is not a random event. That happens when other things are present. High valuations, deteriorating technicals, all the things. So instead of focusing on, hey, 95% of the time, real investment choices should be based on what causes that 5% to not play nicely. So same thing here with the sell and get may go away. It just so happens in history, it is a seasonally weak season. I think if you go back to 1945, the May to October period average is like 2% returns versus like 6.7 for the other months. And some of the biggest down events in history happened in like October, for example, the peak in the market before the housing bubble, the crash of 87, you know, you name it. It's replete with lots of gory. So the sell in May slogan oftentimes is just a construct of the averages catching those negative events. But there are times where May and October are just fabulous times to invest. But again, there are times, usually when they're not good times to invest, is when you have some of the ingredients that we have now, and some of those ingredients are starting to look like they're fall further into place. So we do think, not because of the slogan, but because of the situation, the high valuations, the interest rate tug of war here, some evidence of a slowing economy, that slogan has some merit, especially if you are very heavily invested and taking on more risk than you need to, not because of the slogan, but because of the set of situations that we have right now.
Okay. So Q1 was a phenomenally good quarter, coming off of a strong Q4 as well. So it sounds like you would say, John, kind of given what you're looking at the markets right now, like even if you want to say, oh, market was up in January, maybe going to be up, you know, for the full year, probably time, if you're sitting on some big gains, to harvest some of those gains now, right? Just mm-hmm. to reduce the risk.
Take an objective review. The market was down a little over 5% peak to trough in April. I think it ended April a little below 4% loss. Even a 60-40 kind of traditional allocation was down like almost 4%, I believe. You know, our clients did far better than that, I'm glad to say, because of some of our positioning and hedging. We lost a little bit of money in April, but just because we've seemingly found a short-term bottom and are testing some of these short-term technicals, I wouldn't say, hey, you know, it's all clear. It's a great time to be reassessing your overall allocation. If you're 100% in stocks, absolutely. There's plenty of good reasons, or even very heavily invested in stock, plenty of good reasons to think about repositioning, reallocating to some more defensive sectors, taking some chips off the table. We'll remind folks that we still have short-term treasury bills, which we have about 40% in our client portfolios, that are yielding 5.25 plus right now. There's places to play it safe and still do pretty darn well with your capital.
All right. And you said that, you know, sort of historically, May through October delivers 2%, and, you know, no guarantee what it's going to do this year, but let's say it does the historical average. And if you sit in T-bills for that period, you're crushing the market with safety. Yeah. You can sleep at night.
Yeah. And if it does turn out to be one of the bad May through October, you know, 2% would be a gift. You know, there's plenty of years where 2% would be awesome, and instead you lost big, right? So,
right. Given the 87 crash style corrections. Exactly. All right. Well, look, we got to start wrapping it up there, Mike. I'll give you just a quick sec to comment on this if you have anything to say, but we have seen a correction, or maybe a sell-off, maybe not an official correction, in both gold and Bitcoin. Gold's down about $100 an ounce since its all-time highs, but it kind of got there through a couple of days where it was down like $50 an ounce or more. So it did have a couple of gut-wrenching days that I'm guessing maybe have a few precious metals holders a little worried. And Bitcoin, it dropped below 58,000 briefly. It's a bit above that right now. But 58,000 is important because that's the average purchase price for the average Bitcoin holder. So, you know, it briefly got to the point where the average holder was actually now at a loss. Like I said, I think it's at 59 at the time we're recording this. But both of these assets have had some pretty dramatic cooling off. And just wondering if you think there's anything notable about that.
Yeah, a couple comments just from a technical perspective. And I guess I'll start with gold because we follow gold a lot more closely than Bitcoin. But totally agree with you, Adam. They have been highly correlated, particularly in recent times. And they both are, you know, they're both pretty well, or they're both relatively off their high in the same time frame. But let's start by just sharing the chart again so we can go through this. So here's gold. This is ticker symbol GLD as a proxy. All right. So this charting platform doesn't have the futures. So let's use GLD. So first of all, let's start it with the monthly chart. We've been talking about this really over and over again, this 15-year pattern. A clear breakout. This month of April was a big up month. Now we did close down towards the bottom and it's got people worried, but focus on this. This was a big breakout, a multi-year breakout. So this was no joke. This was a big move and it got everyone excited, maybe a little bit too excited, too fast. And all of this happened while the dollar has been relatively strong and strengthening. So that's been a good sign. If we zoom in a little bit more to the daily chart, this is the move that nobody was kind of anticipating. A few months ago, we had this kind of this, you know, depressing move down. The miners moved down, and, you know, gold bulls were once again saying, well, we've been fooled. And, you know, when will this ever end? When will this, you know, this never-ending disappointment end? Well, in a stealth way, we've just broke right out and went up a few hundred dollars. And we had a move up in GLD that had gold itself that looked like a short-term blow off a couple weeks ago. Now, I don't think that the top is in gold. And for the people that follow Elliott Wave out there, there's something that I guess I'd like to point out, that we had basically a three-wave move up. One small pullback at two, and then the third wave, which is usually the most powerful one, right there. And so that would, if you believe at all in that, and that's only one of many things that we look at, but we think it's got some validity, that normally you've got a five-wave move, that this is probably wave four, and then we probably see wave five here to a new high over the next week, you know, weeks to months. Still, we think that gold gets towards 2,500 pretty quickly, probably overshoots it some, and, you know, pulls back later. Maybe we see something, you know, like a move towards, towards 3,000 in the next couple of months that pulls back to 2,500. Who knows? The bottom line, though, is I don't think this is done. This pullback here with a gap down the other day, everyone's kind of, you know, sad about it. The gold bulls are saying, oh, once again, it looks like we might be, you know, ever suffering bulls here, because we've seen this before and it's fallen right back into the pattern. I don't think that's what's going to happen here. I think that we're going to see another move higher, another wave higher. I think it's going to put in a new high above 2,500, and I think it's going to happen relatively soon. I think the gold stocks will start to catch up. They've already started to catch up, but they've been relatively disappointing compared to the metal. Here's GDX, a proxy for gold stocks. Here's a long downtrend line. They finally broke out. This is on a weekly basis, and we've been ping-ponging back and forth between 32 and 35. I believe that this resolves to the upside as gold resolves to the upside. And then we see GDX move pretty quickly towards 40 over the next weeks to months. That's what we see. It's hard to hold on, though, for the bulls. But the key is this downtrend line, we are consolidating above that downtrend line on gold stocks. And so we still have our full position in gold stocks, relatively a 10% weighting in the portfolio. We recommend that people own gold and silver as well, to the tune of 5 to 10% of investable assets. It takes a lot of patience, though, Adam, particularly after gold bulls have been disappointed for so long. So let's see if that moves higher. One or two more quick things. Silver looks similar. Here's silver on a weekly chart. It broke through its downtrend. Look how volatile this has been. It's hard for silver bulls to hold on here, but I think they should. I think that's moving higher as well. If I went to a monthly chart, you can see how big of a triangle that silver chart has been, and then we break out to the upside. And if we clear this and start moving up again, we should move right into the 30s on silver. But for now, we've got to sit on our hands and wait. The last thing you mentioned was Bitcoin. Let's just put one of the many Bitcoin ETFs up there. These don't have long charts because they haven't been out a long time. That recent high back here, March 12th or so, was around 70,000 Bitcoin. As you say, we're right around 58, 59,000. Bitcoin's been going through this downtrend channel here, we've been noticing, ping-ponging between, you know, both sides of this downtrend channel. I think that if gold hits a new high, Bitcoin is almost certainly going to hit a new high as well. For the Bitcoin bulls out there, this is probably a pretty good time to add if you don't have a position. And I would expect that we probably get a breakout here along with gold and hit a new high as well. So less conviction on that because we follow gold a lot closer.
All right. Thanks, Mike. Super helpful to go through those charts. I got to start wrapping up. John, I'm reminded you wanted to say something about the yen. Give us the quick elevator pitch, and then we'll let you talk more about it next week.
Yeah, absolutely. And one more quick thing on the gold. So we have been selling some short-term call options on the miners. So we've been taking in some premium. Those expired. The current round we have expired this Friday. So we'll look to do that. The recent pullback is not entirely surprising. Got really overbought on a short-term basis, but Mike's, you know, charts in the long term still look very constructive. But yeah, big headline in the last week or so has been the yen has absolutely sold off dramatically relative to the dollar. And I'll share a chart here in a second to look at that with folks. This is a an ETF that tracks the yen. So it's not the actual futures, but so this is a daily chart. You can see here a couple of days ago, it spiked way down, meaning that got devalued relative to the dollar. It actually hit 160 yen per dollar. You know, hasn't been that level in a good long time. I can't remember the last time. It might have been 1990. Anyways, the yen has Japan has intervened very massively the last couple of days. So we've had a very sharp rally in the yen. But this is huge because it underpins a lot of the financial plumbing of the system. The carry trade where people essentially borrow in yen and go invest in other higher yielding or higher growth type of things. That can be, if we get a sharp reversal here, that could be a really big catalyst. But it also plays into the Fed policy and even what is likely the case for longer term treasury bonds. You know, the Japan is in a quandary. You know, one way to defend their yen is to go out and raise interest rates, which really is a catch 22 because it really stings in their budget deficits. The other possible chance or option for them as the largest foreign holder of treasuries is to simply sell treasuries. So that could be a kind of catalyst here that is not helpful, especially as the Fed is seemingly starting to get worried about the liquidity in the bond market by lowering the pace of runoff of their balance sheet and things like that. So that's a big event in markets that, you know, doesn't always make it onto the mainstream Main Street news, but it can have big ramifications here in markets.
Okay, I'm glad you flagged that for a whole bunch of reasons, because I'm sure we're going to be talking about it in future videos here. But this week's macro pass for my premium Substack members is from David Hay, and it focuses completely on what's going on with the yen. And you know, when systems are at extremes, you tend to get extreme movements as things eventually find a way back to mean reversion. David, in his piece, goes through, you know, kind of his investment thesis for what he thinks is most likely to happen, and then shares a whole bunch of different ways to play that if you're an interested investor. So anyways, folks, if you're a MacroPass subscriber, you'll look forward to, they'll probably be in your inbox by the time you watch this video. But if you're excited about that, to read that, either become a MacroPass subscriber or go sign up for David's premium Substack directly. All right. Well, look, in wrapping up here, guys, thanks so much, folks. If you enjoyed the conversation with Michael Every, would like him to come back on as soon as he can, please let him know by hitting the like button, then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. Given everything that we've talked about here, both with Michael Every and with Mike Preston and John here, you know, would like to put all that into application into your portfolio, or as the guys from New Harbor said, great time to reassess your allocation of your current portfolio. If you'd like some help with that, consider scheduling a free consultation with one of the financial advisors endorsed by Thoughtful Money, perhaps even John and Mike and their team there at New Harbor. To do that, just go to thoughtfulmoney.com. But just a reminder, these consultations have become very successful. And so we're sending a lot of volume over to these guys. And I just want to ask, they're happy to take it, and they will speak with everybody that reaches out to them and give them all more than their fair due of time. But, you know, only reach out to them if you're really ready to hear what they have to say, you know, take action based on that information, whether you're going to do it yourself or do it with your financial advisor. But make sure that you're really at a mental state where you're ready to take this seriously. So again, if you want to do all that, just go to thoughtfulmoney.com. Filling out that form only takes a couple seconds. John, I'll let you have the last word here.
So Adam, I'd love to use the last word here to remind folks and your viewers that we are going on a roadshow, coming out to see you. In fact, we're going to be holding a couple of events on May 16th in the LA area, San Juan Capistrano, just kind of south of LA. And the very next day, Friday, May 17th, in Palo Alto, south of San Francisco. These are events that we're going to be seeing many of our local clients that we don't always get to see. We have clients across the country, but we're thrilled, and we have plenty of non-clients coming. We would love to fill the rooms, and they're starting to fill up pretty quick here, which is really encouraging. But we're thrilled that, Adam, you're going to be with us in person to help facilitate a dialogue and conversation. And one part of that is you're going to be interviewing an esteemed guest, Jan Van Eck, the CEO of Van Eck Investments. pioneer in precious metals, alternative asset, real asset investing, and more recently, one of the few firms that launched a Bitcoin spot ETF. So I'm sure the conversation that you will help facilitate with Jan will be fascinating. And then he's been so kind to stick on for some live Q&A with our guests. So really looking forward to that. You can go to our website, newharborfinancial.com/events. And there's some links in there to register. Hope we can see many folks there.
All right. Good reminder, John. Really looking forward to it. And folks, I'll put the links to those two events down as the pinned comment underneath this video. Gentlemen, wonderful as usual. Thanks so much for joining us all this week. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.
Thanks, Adam. See you soon.